Today's episode is sponsored by Ellacraft AI. What if you could compress weeks of due diligence work into minutes? Ellacraft AI makes this possible with the first closed AI-powered platform designed for allocators that automatically generates comprehensive due diligence reports with institutional-grade accuracy. Get investment-grade diligence without the manual grind. Check them out at Ellacraft.ai. That's Ellocraft.ai. And be sure to tell them Angelo sent you.
We know where we're going to go. We know how much risk we want to take. We know how much it's tracking error, how much we deviate from the benchmark, right? Like, why don't I have my, have my army of agents, right? And then Our decision-making is essentially just, around, again, risk tolerance, understanding our employers, understanding the stakeholders, understanding things that they don't want to invest in, and then tell the agent to go to work, right? And then, kind of report back. I think that's the other branch where it's sort of, okay, helping us insource things that we can't insource for potentially a lower cost, and then concentrating on the areas where we're still always going to need to have fund selection.
Welcome to The Institutional Edge, a weekly podcast in partnership with Pensions Investments. I'm your host, Angelo Calvello. In each 30-minute episode, I interview asset owners, the investment professionals deploying capital, who share insights on carefully curated topics. Occasionally, we feature brilliant minds from outside of our industry driving the conversation forward. No fluff, no vendor pitches, no disguised marketing. Our goal is to challenge conventional thinking, elevate the conversation, and help you make smarter investment decisions, but always with a little edginess along the way. So this is the final episode in our AI and institutional investing series. And our topic today is leapfrogging to multi-agentic systems, the future of pension fund management, a topic that I might have inspired in a paper I wrote called Investment Management in a Box. In this paper, I argued that it is conceptually possible to use multiple agents to replicate an investment management business. And my guest today, Antonio Rodriguez, well, he picked up on this idea and he made it his own. Antonio is the Director of Investments at Building Services 32BJ Benefit Funds, a $10 billion multi-employer pension and benefits fund serving commercial and residential building workers throughout New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and the East Coast. Antonio's bio is in the show notes. Antonio, thank you for joining me today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Angelo. Really excited to discuss this topic.
Thank you. And if you permit me, we're talking about kind of a technical topic today. I'd like to provide a little background and maybe set the table because some of our audience members just may not be familiar with AI agents. And I'm going to start by saying you've got these LLMs from Anthropic and ChatGPT, and these are basically chatbots where an AI agent, it's built on an LLM, but it's a program that could actually go out in the world and do something. So let's say you're going to use ChatGPT to help you with a plan a trip, an itinerary. Well, it can give you personalized suggestions for hotels and sites and maybe even a daily itinerary. Whereas an agent would be able to do all that and it would book your flights and your hotels for you. And like an LLM, an agent is initialized with human prompts that contain detailed descriptions of their behavior, their functions, their memories, and their relationships. And what's relevant to us today is that these agents can be combined in several different ways to work together to perform a variety of tasks. And these multi-agentic systems, they act much like humans. They collaborate, they communicate, they negotiate, and they adapt in real time to changes in the environment. They perform tasks, they solve problems, and they achieve complex goals that would challenge any single agent. And we're seeing more and more companies beginning to incorporate these agents into their business models and business plans. A PwC survey of 300 executives in May found that 88% say their teams are planning to increase their AI-related budgets in the next 12 months due to agentic AI. One clear example that I always see is Toyota. They built a multi-agentic system called Cubea, not big on the name, and they use it to speed up the design of powertrains, and it's working. So we've got this powerful, transformative technology, yet we don't see broad adoption in our own industry. So Antonio, to you, how are you thinking about agents and their adoption in the institutional investment industry, and specifically, maybe even in your own business models?
Angelo, I do really appreciate kind of the introduction. And kind of before I dive into it, I want to really discuss this from the point of view of an allocator. And many times you think about allocators, particularly in the pension world, whether multi-employer, maybe to a lesser extent, the public world, where we've always been kind of tech light, I guess is the best way to think about it. That oftentimes you think about technology adoption kind of writ large, whether it was, you know, it really going back to the SaaS platforms, to portfolio analytic tools, things like that. We're oftentimes a generation or so behind. And you could say that you know, the procurement process or the our ability to essentially take risk when it comes to technology, I mean, that level of adoption, we've always had issues as organizations because there's never been necessarily that pressure, right? Either it's the procurement, our procurement policies, or taking technology risk, not being necessarily part of our mandate. But I see agents as a huge opportunity, right? Because what are the typical complaints for many of the of investment offices in either again in the public realm or ones that are in the multi-employer space is that we are, you know, people light, that essentially we have a tough time hiring oftentimes because of salary and compensation considerations. It's the first one. And then I would say second is that because of that, you know, we can't hire and we have a harder time hiring. You know, we're always kind of behind the times. We always are kind of overworked. I think being tech light in this case actually is a kind of an opportunity, right? I liken it to kind of the mobile revolution where ideas in, let's say, reading things about places in like Kenya, things like that, where you could kind of leapfrog the landline movement and go straight to mobile. And I think about that for our organizations that ultimately, given that we were behind many of the, I guess, the more, I guess, kind of tech forward allocators, that we're able to actually, you know, not have some of the problems and some of the legacy issues, again, whether it's kind of SaaS, whether it's, you know, having to have this, you know, massive kind of Bloomberg terminal and paying, you know, lots of money for that to integrate all that information. And so to me, I think that's where the opportunity lies, right? And really the question is, can our governance, can our decision-making, can our processes, will we allow them to get out of the way essentially, right? Get out of the way for kind of technological kind of innovation. And what are those particular barriers, again, in our processes and our governance? And how can we be thoughtful about moving forward? How do we get our trustees, how do we get other staff members comfortable with, in kind of the early going, outsourcing some of the processes and even a little bit of the decision-making long-term to agents with the right guardrails in place?
From my perspective, you're thinking about, you're starting from sort of a deficiency, mm-hmm. and you're able to leapfrog into the next generation of AI, in my view, these multi-agentic systems. And if I understood you right, you're being driven by, how would I say, resource constraints in many ways. And you're looking to overcome those resource constraints with artificial intelligence.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, oftentimes, you know, resource constraints are the engine for innovation, right? Or they can be, I should say. They're not always, right? They can be the engine of for innovation. And I oftentimes think about that for organizations in our situation, where if you cannot necessarily pay for a particular talent and you don't have necessarily the line items to hire just a ton of bodies, yeah. right? That what are the ways that you can overcome that? And I think for us, and why I'm interested in kind of exploring is that first, what are the areas that are difficult to hire and train for, or there's impatience around that? And then from there, again, how do you build the particular guardrails in place from a governance standpoint? And the thing that's interesting about all of that is our portfolios are no less complex. And I think that's where things get, yeah, you can solve for it the other way, right? You can solve for our resource deficiencies by having a less complex portfolio. And some places have, right? Since we're not going to have the number of line items, we're not going to move in alternatives, we're not going to do co-investments, we're not going to do, I call it kind of like, you know, endowment envy, right? Like, we're not going to move into the endowment model. A few places have kind of done that, right? But our portfolios are no less complex as a whole, right? And so, so you have to go one of two ways, right? And then if you want to have that complex portfolio, I think increasingly with all of the data, right? If you think about how much of even a person in the strategy realm's job is operations, if you think about somebody who, whether it's analyst, at how much it's gathering information, how much it's logging into portals, how much it's answering the same questions over and over again, looking up particular performance, standardizing performance. There are so many tasks for anybody within, even in the strategy realm, certainly in places like ours where everybody has to be kind of a generalist, but even at larger organizations, right? Like a public pension fund that may have, you know, hundreds of staff, I don't know if you'd be surprised at how much of their job is still very much really kind of operational data gathering. And it makes it very difficult to do the analytical work that you're ostensibly paying people to do.
So you're talking about operational efficiency being achieved. Mm-hmm. You're mm-hmm. overcoming the resource constraints that you might have. You're dealing with a technology that could help with the complexity of portfolios. And I don't know how important this is to you, but you could also do 24-hour monitoring. You know what I mean? These things, they don't sleep. Where your staff, your colleagues, they go home. So it does, you know, kind of make a lot of sense, just speaking about it from a pension fund perspective, as being quite additive.
Absolutely.
So if you had this system, how would you use it? I mean, we know it's some of the, you know, you're overcoming some barriers, you've got some benefits, but how do you think you'd use it?
So I think in this is something that I think is kind of most important in the beginning, right? It's I think really around some of the what you'd call kind of the ancillary tasks, right? And those can be kind of twofold. The first I would call your ops, not necessarily investment applications, but applications that support the investment function, I think, right? And so those fall into two categories, right? Where there's all of the legal work that you're doing, like the first pass, right? Like, for instance, we get a ton of, you know, you get all your LPAs, your subdocs, you get all of that information that either A, you're you know, hiring, you know, someone to fill out, you have an analyst that's doing it, you may outsource some of that, you may have, in some cases, a law firm doing that where you're paying law firm fees in order for that to happen. I think that first level is being able to fill in the repetitive tasks, you know, whether it's KYC, where it's AML. And so taking it like post-decision, right? So post-decision mm-hmm. around the investment or fund selection process, right? And I'm talking about this from a fund allocator. Obviously, it's look different allocators that manage some money in-house. But as a fund allocator, the first step would be, okay, after the decision's made, what are all the tasks that are channeled, right? And so you have a few. You have to, the account opening with the custodian as one example. If you have a portfolio analytics system, you have to put in, you know, hey, make sure that fund is created there as well, like analogous to the custodian so you can build that feed. How is it categorized? What part of the portfolio is it in? What strategy and how do you categorize that? What the benchmark is? So putting all of that stuff into place, right? You have, again, you could trigger, you know, kind of KYC, AML, subdocs, LPA, side letter negotiations. You're essentially triggering a bunch of tasks, some of which don't need a ton of negotiation and are repetitive. Again, for the most part, you know, the subdocs are going to be 95% the same. There might, you know, a manager could ask a couple of relevant questions that are different than what you saw in fund three, right? But for the most part, those are incredibly repetitive, but they add on to the kind of the task burden for a small office, right? In our office, we have about five people who are working on all of this, right? And with some help from admins and things like that, some people pinch hitting, but it's a core group of five, and having meetings where, okay, we get to the portfolio analysis after we go, because the money has to get sent. All of this stuff precedes the actual analysis on your decision making. So that's one area where immediately I think the amount of time that it would save is massive, especially as though if we can get the costs down tremendously. Performance, right? Like performance reporting, the generation of reports on a monthly and quarterly basis. Nothing out of the box looks really good, right? I can't tell you, and I imagine this is something that this may have you feel as well with regard to design, but the amount of time spent on templates and design and changes that trustees want to see, or on a quarterly basis, how do you visualize information and the thinking behind it? Having somebody do that thought process for you, and there's part of that already done. Like I've used Copilot before to help design reports, right, or design presentations. There's still a lot of work to be done. I think an agent can take that to the next level where it's not just the design, but now you're doing design and content, and you're not going to have to do kind of a really thorough pass on whether or not the content is correct. Yes, there's hallucinations, but being able to get 75 or 80% there, I think that's, you know, long term, that's being conservative, right? So I think those two right away today, performance and the task after fund selection, would increase the productivity of our team an untold amount, so that we spend more time talking about the portfolio and less time talking about all of the tasks that precede conversations on whether or not we made the right decision.
It's interesting the way you lay this out. It aligns with a lot of the research I've seen in this space, where they talk about staging. You don't want to build what I talked about, the whole box. You want to stage this, and you want to deal with some of the more, I think you used the term operational, you know, kind of, you made the funding decision. Now we have to fund and go through this process. Is that how you're thinking about this conceptually? You would stage this and work your way into it?
Yeah. And I think there's a lot of practical reasons why you would want to stage this, right? And I'm going to actually kind of work backwards on this a little bit, right? Because, you know, if you're thinking about like, what is the actual biggest reason, I'm going to use my fund in an ERISA context before a public context, because I think it crystallizes the issue more. The ultimate fiduciary is the trustees at the end of the day. And legally, there has to be a human, certainly not necessarily in certain process loops, but at the end of the process, a human has to be there. And that human is, or those people are multiple steps removed from any of these processes, right? Like they have staff, those staff have consultants, we hire managers, managers pick securities. So they're 5, 6, 7 steps removed from this process, right? And so it's already not necessarily opaque, but it's not transparent, it's translucent, right? It's a translucent process for the trustees. Adding in a agent or kind of adding AI writ large to the loop may take something that's translucent to make it opaque. That's the ultimate barrier, right? And so you have to stage it, right? And you can get away with that if the returns are good. You can get away with almost anything if the returns are good. Honestly, that's why I think tech light, like US stock market does well. You can get rid of, like, we have managers who are still using, you know, Excel-based trade tickets, right? Like, you can get away with all of that stuff with being technology light if the returns are there, right? And I honestly think that's the other barrier towards adoption. So because returns are paramount in our industry, the best way to introduce technology, I believe, is through areas that people don't necessarily think of as having an immediate effect on the risk and return in a portfolio. I'd argue that it does, right? But I think that there is, you know, because it's a few steps removed from the, you know, hey, how much did we make versus our peers versus the benchmark, and what was the volatility of the portfolio? I think that that is why starting in areas where you know, they may not have the immediate impact, where it's sort of, oh, this is the, lack of a better word, this is the grunt work, right? This is the grunt work that has to get done in order for us to proceed. But it is really seen as a barrier to the processes that actually get us to what pays our beneficiaries, which is the returns on the assets they contribute on a monthly basis.
Okay, so I get the staging. I understand, you know, your focus, but blue sky with me here, man. Where would you go? Because let's assume that there's been some metrics. Those metrics have been met on the operational side. Legal's good with this. You brought up an important point. You put up the guardrails. There's a human in the loop. The human's going to, if you decide to have ultimate decision-making and responsibility, somebody's got to own it. Let's assume all that's working okay. Where do you go from here? I mean, would you take it to the investment decision-making process? I mean, what would you do?
I'd take it up to that brink, right? Because if I'm thinking about, right, let's get to the committee room, right? Mm-hmm. Let's bring it to the committee room. You know, you have the 4 or 5 folks in the table, whoever's on the IC plus your observers. And maybe it's your board, maybe it's discretionary at the staff level. I'd take it almost up to that point, right? From a selection standpoint. Again, I'm going to selection, but I'll talk about kind of rebalancing and tactical allocations later. And everyone's working off the same particular information. It's not, you try and remove some of the biases. I don't know if it would ultimately make the committee decision, but it would narrow the pipeline. It would certainly narrow the pipeline. I'd go so far to say that the top of the funnel all the way to the options presented at committee, I think can ultimately be done by those agents, where you kind of give it the guidelines and you go. I think in from a rebalancing and tactical asset allocation standpoint, the human stakes have become the guardrails, right? And so you're setting the limits on how much risk you want to take. And so you, let's say you have a target of, you know, broadly speaking, 50% global equities, you know, 25% fixed income, 25% alts, just as a, that you set the bands and then the agent is able to trade within those particular bands, right? That that ultimately you say, here's how much capital we're going to need for to pay benefits. And the agent decides where you source it from if you don't have enough cash to pay that much. I do think long term you get there where it's, again, you are, because the humans at the end of the day have to own the risk, the humans have to be the risk managers, right? Again, at least for our purposes, you know, I won't speak for other allocators, but certainly for allocator whereby there is a strong fiduciary obligation that the risk management, because it, again, the risks, the legal risk from a participant's perspective, the cash, right? At the end of the day, if we have a shortfall, the benefits are paid for by either cash from the employers or lower benefits over time for our members, that if human owns a risk, the humans have to be the risk managers. But everything else in between, I think you can ultimately give to an agent. So research, for instance, certainly, like I got 14, you know, that's like 14 tabs on this window open. I got probably 45 tabs of different research that I'm going to get to, right? Like everything from, you know, our private credit managers, they're kind of the latest with regard to you know, kind of where they think interest goes, like all that stuff. We get so much research and I'm never able to collate it. So like research function, absolutely. And then you, like the agent prepares my daily briefing. And or prepares my daily briefing for all of my analysts, right? Because in reporting, absolutely. Operations, trade, all that, like I believe all of that stuff long term, if we're blue skying it, that task design, task implementation, and then, you know, ultimately even the agents can necessarily have suggestions. Right? Like if they're kind of fully autonomous, and that's where I think we do have to be careful. It's kind of reporting. The one question I have on that, right, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this too, is how do we train the next level of decision makers if they're not doing those kind of repetitive tasks to learn, right? Like I think I've learned more about our portfolio when I was first starting out by data entry. I learned about the portfolio through data entry, the repetition of, all right, here are the names of the managers. Here's how they're going to interact. Like, how do you train people when the training, you're now saying, okay, we're going to train the agent that shows up all the time already. Like I do worry a little bit about kind of the what effects that has on junior staff if they're not, in some cases, learning alongside the agents, right? And finding a way to have them almost be like agent apprentices, right? In some ways, right? How could you do something like that? Maybe ask the agent to make a training model for new decision makers. But I do think, in the beginning, getting off, again, all the kind of communications, operations, tactical asset allocation to an agent to spend more time on the strategic, having a strategic focus, stakeholder engagement, I think are going to be the areas where more and more of those skills are going to be for, to be able to kind of communicate all of that to your stakeholders, whether it's board or beneficiaries or you know, the folks contributing to the plan.
I'm going to give you three comments, if I could remember them all at my age. The first is, there's actually a VC firm, I believe based in Hong Kong, that now has an AI agent on its investment committee.
Oh, wow.
Second, you talked about tactical asset allocation and you're moving, you know, away from the operational side into the investment decision-making side. I read a couple papers last week and one of them in particular stood out for me. They built a hedging agent. And the research looked really good to me. I'm not going to endorse it, but it was peer reviewed. This paper was peer reviewed before it was accepted into a rather prestigious symposium. But man, I didn't think we had come that far that fast, but I'm already seeing these agents acting in a way that I thought we were a ways away from. I'll admit my naivete. So going to your TAA, I mean, that's basically, you know, kind of a risk decision within your bands. I mean, you pick the periodicity, your liquidity needs, et cetera. So this stuff is happening now.
And oh, man.
The third point is, you asked me, what about staff? You learned really from the ground up. And you were looking at spreadsheets and you were, you know, talking to your mentors at the time. I'm not sure we're going to see those same types of individuals hired. I'm more inclined to think you might be hiring someone that's more fluent in data than they are in investing. You may be hiring people that are fluent as prompt engineers and understand, you know, retrieval augmented generation. So, you know, I don't want to say you're going to lose these jobs, but the skills that go into those jobs, that are required to do those jobs, just might be different if you move to a multi-agentic system.
Absolutely. And I almost think that it comes into two forms, right? Folks who are, it's almost in so many areas in our society, right? I'll say that the middle, right? The generalist, right? That middle kind of goes away as you move to specialist, again, either in the data realm or in the communication realm, right? Because again, at the end of the day, if there's a, because, you know, and we are agents, right? Like, you know, I'm an agent, right, of the principals, right? And so being able to communicate to the principal, you know, I'm an agent that needs sleep. I'm an agent that needs to go home, play with his kids and everything like that. But I'm an agent, right, of my principals. And being able to communicate to those principals, I think, is still right now the skill that is necessary. So you have to have, I think you're going to move to one of those kind of barbells, kind of one or the other. And so I think that that's going to look good. But the other thing I'm concerned about, and this is something that we always, another barrier to technology adoption is who, right? Like if the idea is that we're all convinced that at some point, let's say we're all convinced that pension management in a box, that having multiple agents, multiple specialized agents to run kind of your, you know, at least at the very least operations and even some kind of investment in strategic decision making in at your pension fund makes sense, right? But there, you know, unless we believe there's going to be one kind of vendor for all of this, the other concern I have is, especially in a relative game like what we play, the vendor selection becomes paramount. Right.
Yeah.
And already, right, like again, I understand enough to be able to do a portfolio analytics system, right? Like even if I don't necessarily know everything on the back end, I know what I want, right? With regard, I know what I want to see visually. I know what's easy to work with, what's not easy to work with, right? So I can given the reps, I can understand what I'm looking for and then how to decide on which vendor to choose. For this, right, I also know what I want, but I think the level of understanding is one that I'm, you know, we have to get to, and I'm not necessarily confident that, again, you're talking about particular skill sets that certainly folks in our allocator seats have, right? Like, and because it's relative, right? And especially if you move into things like, again, trading and fund selection, right? Now, are your agents going head to head? Are you going head to head with somebody else's agent? Certainly, again, on kind of the trading end, from an excess return standpoint, right? Now it's sort of, if it's that battle, that arms race against, for agents, do folks like us get left in the dust, right? Even if we're forward in adopting, how much money are we going to throw at the versus, again, other allocators or other investors who, from their perspective, like that's how they make their money, right? Like I've always worked for places that the money's there, right? Like money's contributed from employees and employers. So I don't have the profit motive, and I don't necessarily have the motive, you know, kind of risk of fundraising in order to push me to say we have to get the best agent possible. So we want to do a good job for our beneficiaries. But I think about that a lot with regard to vendor selection is really, does the vendor selection of the move from who has the best due diligence process to who is able to work with or prompt an agent to do better, right? Like, and that becomes, I think, the thinking about this new relative game, because again, from a excess return standpoint or a peer benchmarking standpoint, right? Like we are in a relative game, even though we should sometimes act like we're more in an absolute game, we're in a relative game when it comes to investment management.
A quick break to talk about Elecraft AI. I've been following how AI can transform due diligence and find most platforms give allocators more data, not better decisions. Elecraft AI flips the script by providing decision-ready intelligence that actually moves the needle. Instead of drowning in dashboards, you get the tedious work done for you. Summarizing documents, flagging risks, and writing IC memos so your team can focus on what matters most. Making those critical high conviction calls. Transform your pipeline from backlog to competitive advantage at Elecraft AI. Go to Elecraft.ai to schedule a demo and discover the AI due diligence platform allocators deserve. You're getting into the issue of implementation here, and you've kind of conceded you're not going to build this internally. You already admitted early on your resource constraints. So you want to find a supplier.
Yes.
That is going to be able to meet your, you know, your initial and your future needs. You want to make sure the supplier's got enough runway that they don't go out of business in 6 months. But you also want to be sure in this relative game that they're not using your data to train their own models on so other people could use that. There's a data privacy issue.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the other issues, though. Not implementation, but just using agents. You already mentioned hallucinations, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've got this issue of data privacy. That's a big one.
Yeah.
I could keep going, but hey, man, you're the guest, not me.
Well, here's what's interesting, I think, and one of the benefits for us, right, and you see this in, I'm going to use an example on how much easier it is on the asset side, and, you know, because, yeah, I think about the pension world kind of writ large. I'm on the asset side, I'm on the investing side, but I'm on the senior leadership team. We have conversations on the benefit side as well. How much easier it is on our side than on the benefit side, right? The costs on the benefit side from a technological implementation is an order of magnitude larger than it is on the investment side. Benefit management systems. We're in a world that's somewhat standardized, right? The regulatory guidelines, whether federal or state, I think make it so that there's a lot of standardized information. It's how you use that information. I worry less about data privacy for us because, you know, if you want to look up everything that we invest in, you can do it. You go to the Department of Labor, right? Like, we have to list everything. When I was at the public, mm-hmm. we had to list it in our annual financial reports, right? It's all there. So you can look in the selection process. When I worked in, you know, Nevada, you could go to the meeting, right? Like, you see the agenda, right? So from a allocator's perspective, I'm less worried about data privacy than I would be on the benefit side. But the truth is that, like, at the end of the day, we are moving lots of money to beneficiaries sometimes who are, you know, they're of retirement age or older. You know, we're all on the same network, right? And so, you know, it's kind of less issues if it's cloud-based and stuff like that. But I guess my bigger take is that we may be a gateway to information that, you know, people who want to do harm or steal money want to get to, right? Like, again, ours will be like account numbers, wiring instructions, things like that, right? Where those games can kind of play. And that's where, in some ways, we haven't talked about the asset managers kind of on their side, how much humans are going to be in the loop there when there's that risk of, you know, either accepting money from customers you don't know or sending distributing proceeds back to particular someone that you don't know. I guess my take is, like, so yeah, I'm less worried about kind of the data privacy from the investment standpoint. I'm worried about the data privacy from us being a gateway to folks getting in and you know, taking a beneficiary's check, right? Like that yeah. would be where we have to think about the cybersecurity holistically as a big issue.
Okay, so you've hit one. I'm going to throw out there's these technical issues. You've got model collapse possibilities with agents. And there was a paper that Anthropic put out maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, and it talked about something called agentic misalignment, where models from, regardless of the developer, they resorted to malicious insider behavior where they were basically blackmailing officials and leaking sensitive information. Oh. And, you know, there's a brilliant data scientist, Gary Marcus. He looked at this from a technical perspective and said, nobody in the industry knows how to stop this. I mean, it's one of the problems with this. So it's basically a security vulnerability that we're looking at here. And I would assume when you're going through your procurement process, you're asking your prospective vendors to say, how do you deal with hallucinations, model collapse, you know, agent misalignment? And then you're in a position where you have to make that decision, or you hire a consultant that sits next to you at the meeting that may be more, I'll say, technically competent in this area. And no disrespect, but you're not a data scientist.
No, I'm not a data scientist. Yeah. And in fact, this is more about, like, we'd obviously, it'd be for us, we'd hire a consultant for it, right? Like, we're not making this decision often enough to hire someone, to have somebody on staff who's looking at this, right? From even our IT folks, and maybe long-term that happens, right? Maybe, yeah. You know, this gets integrated long enough where your IT staff, certainly they know more, but the idea that they're going to be able to do a search for particular agents, again, we're just using, you know, from the LLM perspective, chatbots for, like, things like, you know, client service, right, or member services, to answer questions about your, you know, summary plan document or point you in the right direction. That, I think, is an area where we're already seeing those changes. And, you know, again, I think because so much of our, from their perspective, their bread and butter is get our members. But, you know, I think that for us, it would be very much a, you have to hire a consultant to do it. And then, you know, kind of what your trust is. And then the real question is, for us, are there enough, is there enough expertise and cost-effective expertise to move that way? And then the justification at the end of the day, how much better returns can we get? Because I think we've talked through all and why it's so much easier to talk about kind of the burden, the operational burden versus the investment decision-making is because there are real costs, right? Whether in time or in, you know, actual kind of person hours, additional consultants, lag, opportunity costs for having a long implementation process for onboarding a fund, a longer search process, taking longer to rebalance. All of that decision-making is easily quantifiable. But from the in investment and selection standpoint, right, one thing I think about is we don't do a great job, I think, internally of measuring the counterfactual. I'd love to have a counterfactual agent that essentially you're running in making decisions because there's a tree effect, right? Like, let's say I said I wanted X small cap manager or S private equity manager, not Y. But essentially having agents kind of run another portfolio, but there are decisions on top of those decisions, right? Like, if I make X decision, you know, that tree, that binomial tree ends up moving further and further away from each other over time. I'd love to kind of play with that. We don't do a great job of measuring the counterfactual in our kind of current process. We only have time. But I say that why, you know, at the end of the day, it is much more difficult to kind of measure. We diversified, and honestly, if we would just had all, like, you know, if we had all our money in NVIDIA, right, you know, benefits would have improved even more, right? Like, but, you know, we have all that volatility, right? Sometimes the simplest answer is the best one. And so I guess my point on that one is it is harder to kind of measure it, or it's much more multifaceted than in the operations where I think the clear case for automation through agents is already there, right? Like, in the idea of like whether or not you want to be the first mover, but I could, if I snap my fingers tomorrow, can have it all. I could go to the board and say, here's how much money I think we'll save on ODD. Here's how much money I think we could save from having multiple layers of consultants. Here's how much time I think we can save from fund decision to onboarding. Right, like that is something that we can do, and I think that's why the it's easier to make that case. But, you know, we know there's a lot of luck in investment management, and so, you know, you can do all the right things, right? You're of a process that's pristine, and lose out to somebody who threw a dart at a board, right? Like, and so, you know, that I think is why.
Yeah, but it's the process that matters in your seat. Is. I know it. I mean, I'm vice chair of a little police pension board here, and oversee the investments. I keep telling the officers, it's all about process. If we were that good, you guys wouldn't be police officers. We'd all be running our own hedge funds or creating our own family offices.
100%.
But it goes back to your comment about staging again. You know, you're thinking of this. Yeah, it's a leapfrog, but it's a leapfrog where you're not saying it's all done at once. We're going to stage this. And it's interesting, in your last comments, you talked about how the board, from governance structure, would say, yeah, we can see where this makes sense with the right guardrails, a human in the loop. And you could say we can actually save money and improve, you know, staff's use of time, because governance is always an issue. But by staging it and demonstrating empirically that there's actual value here, it's easier to take it to the next stage.
Absolutely.
There's one other point about the counterfactual. I mean, there are multi-agentic systems that build in critics, and those critics could play the role. We invested in manager A, but how do we do if we would have done it in manager B? And, you know, you're thinking about it conceptually, but it's already being done, man. You're seeing this already.
One other thing, and I don't know if you've seen any research on this, and I'm thinking about this, and I was going back to sometimes in like our big managers, our large managers, especially the ones attached to kind of the custody banks, something like that, they are, you know, even though we complain about them sometimes, they're more technology forward, right? I can trade on their platforms, mm-hmm. everything like that. Some of our boutique managers, they're less technology forward than we are, right? Like in the sense of, and so I also think about, we have other organizations that are part of this kind of chain. And are they going to be willing to interact in some cases with agents? So again, give me the fund opening example where let's say I took, and something's being done now, but like, let's say I wanted to automate the process from, you know, I got a capital call, just a simple capital call, right? And I'm able to you know, but and let's say I messed up the fund docs, right? And so the wire instructions change. Are they going to be willing to interact with an agent, right?
Yeah.
And so then even if we have internal processes that can be automated and kind of putting in the particular instructions, are they going to want to do a callback, right? And if they want to do a callback, right, for a particular large instruction, right? While we've automated some of it, you know, the human is coming in the loop more and more, right? And so there's this interactive effect where that can be another limiting factor. Like, you can be a first mover. And again, because so much of what we do is not about gaining an advantage against another market player, but about implementation of our own decisions, in that aspect, there's sometimes not a ton of benefit of being too far forward of everyone else, because there's not a ton of gain, because maybe some of our other vendors aren't as technology forward and they're going to force us to put a human back in the loop, right? And so it's sort of, we have to kind of stage that a little bit.
So it's two things. One, you point out another implementation barrier. I mean, APIs, they often lack the granular functionality. And second, you may include in your manager diligence, you know, are they AI savvy? I mean, you know, you would have your own part of your operational due diligence. Can they do this? Or are we going to get faxes still? Do we have to communicate by faxes? Are there going to be callbacks? So you would include that in there. And that may not be a reason not to do it, not to invest with the manager, but at least you'll know, in spite of these, let's say, limitations in terms of your multi-agentic system, you still want the manager. We're just going to live with that that human interaction.
Yeah, absolutely. But this is another thing, I think, and this is, I probably should have brought this up before, because when we talked about blue sky, right? My sky wasn't completely blue. There's a few clouds in it, right? Because if I was actually in the blue sky, what is the biggest barrier for us, if we think about it, is that the fact that we have to do the funds manager selection process in the first place, right? Like, if I look at my portfolio analytics system, you know, if I look at my overall portfolio across, you know, public equities, fixed income, alts, right? Like, I'm the market plus or minus, what, 25 basis points, 50 basis points, right? Like, you're going to be around that benchmark over a longer period of time. Honestly, if the agents can get us closer to being able to essentially just run our fund internally, right? Like, that's and I didn't think about it from, again, was still kind of in the mindset as an allocator. If we think about these particular systems, you know, and you'd still do the fund selection in areas that are most important, but, you know, if I look up and I say, okay, I'm basically running a enhanced index, right? Which is, again, big picture, yeah, that's what we're running for most of allocators of our size, of our regulatory framework. And we're running an enhanced index in both fixed income and in equities, you know, and I'm paying a lot of money to run that enhanced index, right? So why not, you know, and the barriers are that, you know, well, you know, I'm not a Wall Street guy, right? Like, I grew up in the allocator realm, right? But we know generally where we're going to go. We know how much risk we want to take. We know how much it's tracking error, how much we deviate from the benchmark, right? Like, why don't I have my army of agents, right? And then our decision-making is essentially just, you know, around, again, risk tolerance, understanding our employers, understanding the stakeholders, understanding things that they don't want to invest in, and then tell the agent to go to work, right? And then, you know, kind of report back. I think that's the other branch where it's sort of, okay, helping us insource things that we can't insource for potentially a lower cost. And then, you know, concentrating on the areas where we're still always going to need to have fund selection.
So going back to the staging though, Antonio, why not continue to do what you're doing in that investment decision-making framework with humans, but let the agents kind of work on their own, but let them paper trade, let's say.
Yeah.
Because the baseline they have to beat is you and your team. You could give the agents the same constraints that the team has to operate under. Tracking error, sharp, liquidity, it doesn't matter. I mean, you build these constraints in your prompt. And you run it side by side. And after 6 months, a year, 2 years, you say, you know what? The agent stinks, or the agent's doing a good job. We're going to let it nibble now a little bit more. So you run it side by side is what I would think.
No, absolutely. And then the other side of it is almost, you know, I don't know if you've seen some of the chess bots, right? They'll make a Magnus Carlsen chess bot, or they'll make like a, right? You can almost make a trusty chess bot, right? I'd love to make a trusty bot where it's sort of, oh, you have to go in front of X trustee and Y trustee this month, right? Like, right? I might be getting too far of a field here, but ultimately, you know, you're kind of playing it all through. Like, if you're going to work under our constraints, you really got to work under our constraints. Yeah. Right. And so you'd have, okay, here's X agent. Right. And to me, that, I think that makes a ton of sense. But I think really what we need is to not be afraid to be a, if not a first mover, then a very quick second mover. Right. I do think that, and again, I think the way you get there is staging. The way you get there is kind of the immediate cost savings and time savings in operations. And again, to your point about staging, on, you know, you can ask it to kind of build a paper, like, but hey, they're making no decisions, right? Like, you're making no decisions. But at the same time, even if they're just paper trading, or even if they're doing a, you can learn from them, right? Like, I think that the mm-hmm. idea that having an agent alongside of you to say, have you considered this? Here are the biases that you all have in your decision making. We all do, right? You know, from a, you know, here's the size of the manager, I'm more into fundamental, more into quantitative. I like Core Satellite completely, right? Like, I think Core Satellite, you know, kind of beta and a little bit of excess return across every single asset class, to me is the best starting point. That might not be right. My rebalancing ranges might be too narrow, and, you know, we should kind of widen them out. Or alternatively, I like to take chips off the table too fast, right? Like, you know, that is, those are all kind of built in through an experience. And I think the last step is, and I think this is something I've talked about, and this is not just technology, but I think technology in general, agents specifically, help solve for this. I think the investment management industry has done a pretty good job of solving for the general, right? Right, that essentially the solutions developed get you 80 to 90% there, right? But if I were really to think about how we should construct a portfolio and how, and the information we should be taking in, right? Who are our members? Our members are, like you said at the beginning, the commercial and residential real estate workers, and mostly in New York, but up and down the East Coast, right? And we have security officers, including the one that passed away, unfortunately, at the shooting at on Park Avenue, was one of our members, right? And we need to solve for them, right? Right at the end of the day. And then the employers who contribute, right? The employers contribute. We need to solve for them, right? And how do we solve for them? Where are the risks in our portfolio that, again, on the margins may, or here are the things that they particularly construct me a portfolio where, you know, and I think certainly the building trades do this on an ad hoc basis, where it's sort of like a dollar contributed by helping us, our members get jobs, actually is incredibly helpful. All right. You can't make it the entire portfolio, but there is a number that makes it work. Or, you know, when I in New York City, I always had this idea that, you know, what is the margin in which an investment in a building in New York both has the return potential, but also the tax base, right? Or kind of the like that mm-hmm. that ultimately gets you there. And again, that's a thought exercise, but those are thought exercises that I'm maybe not skilled enough of a researcher or have the time to do. But, you know, agent that has the entire internet and the smartest minds resources at their disposal. And so to your idea about there's the prompt and how to get it, but then there's more time being able to think about the question. Right. More time. And you thinking about, like, of all this reading, the more time to think about the question, the appropriate question to ask. And I had to say the most exciting thing about that is that gives myself, my team, more time to think about the question. And the appropriate question is the thing that then we have the entities, the agents, technology help us get the answer.
Let's end it here. I've taken up more time than I thought I would, but with you, man, this was a great conversation. It's like
I appreciate like it, man.
It was great. Yes. I mean, there's got to be a paper here for us to write somewhere, don't you think?
Oh, man, absolutely. Listen, once we get these agents going, right, like we'll be able to spend more time asking the questions and writing the papers.
But I got to ask you my final question. I asked this to all my guests. It's got nothing to do with AI agents, but what's the worst pitch you ever heard? You've heard hundreds of pitches in your career, man. What's the worst pitch? And don't throw anybody under the bus. I know you wouldn't do it.
to be fair, most of the time that I get pitches, they're typically institutional. I heard some bad ones. So mine is not necessarily the investment itself. It's how it was done. So this particular firm came through a trustee recommendation, right? And so we had, it was myself and trustee and one other person kind of on the line for an initial pitch. So we're waiting, and it's probably, you know, 5 and 10 minutes, and the person has not gotten on yet, and the firms have gotten on yet. Maybe right before we're like, hey, we're gonna leave, person gets on, and he's on the train. he's the one who set this meeting up, or they're the one who set the meeting up, right? So they're on the train on their phone, right? So like, not even new laptop thing. So they're this is again an initial intro meeting. Trustee set it up again. Director of investments, another trustee on the line on Zoom. And he goes, oh, you know, I'm so sorry that I'm late. I was like, do you want to reschedule? He's like, no, we're good. We're going to have the conversation. And he proceeds not to discuss the investment opportunity, but asks us for sourcing, right? For leads, right? in between the go through the tunnel, right? And so cuts out. And so another like 5-10 minutes pass. And so we're all just texting each other. And then finally gets on from under the tunnel. It's like, I'm so sorry. You know, we had those, I think it's right that we reschedule. And I think we go, you know, I think we're okay. I think we're okay. You know, you made about the worst first impression that you could possibly make. You're the one who set up the meeting. And instead of discussing the fund opportunity, you wanted to talk to us about like leads. You know, so that was if I went through kind of my role, like, there might have been ones that the actual investment opportunity may have been worse, but that was probably the worst kind of first impression and last impression that any investment manager that was trying to win our business had. So
let's hope the lesson was learned by that individual. and I'm sure they did. But Antonio Rodriguez, thank you. This was
Angelo,
wonderful.
This was a pleasure.
I enjoyed the conversation, man.
Absolutely. So, thank you. And I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to visit PNI's website for outstanding content and to hear previous episodes of the show. You can also find us on PNI's YouTube channel. Links are in the show notes. If you have any questions or comments on the episode or have suggestions for future topics and guests, we'd love to hear from you. My contact information is also in the show notes. And if you haven't already done so, we'd really appreciate an honest review on iTunes. These reviews help us make sure we're delivering the content you need to be successful. To hear more insightful interviews with allocators, be sure to subscribe to the show on the podcast app of your choice. Finally, a special thanks to the Northrop family for providing us with music from the Super Trio. We'll see you next time. Namaste.
The information presented in this podcast is for educational and informational purposes only. The host, guests, and their affiliated organizations are not providing investment, legal, tax, or financial advice. All opinions expressed by the host and guests are solely their own and should not be construed as investment recommendations or advice. Investment strategies discussed may not be suitable for all investors, as individual circumstances vary.